Hello, and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, this scale-up marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Renicus.
And I'm Harry Neal. Today's podcast guest is Jason Gibb, founder of Bread & Jam, the UK's biggest food and drinks founders festival. Hello and welcome to Wax Lyrical, Jason. Thank you for joining us.
Very nice to be here.
So before I think we talk about Bread & Jam, it's worth us taking a little bit of time to talk about you, Jason, as you've had quite an interesting journey and career thus far. Could you tell us a little bit about how you've gotten to where you are now?
Yeah, I mean, we can go back quite far if you like, but basically I started off doing science. I did a science PhD, wanted to become a science communicator through doing radio and TV, and it ended up actually, it wasn't quite science TV, but it was in a way. I worked on a show called Scrap Heap Challenge. I don't know if you remember it. It
was a remember, isn't it? It's still on, isn't it? Come on, somewhere it's
no,
being shown.
Just reruns, yeah, oh, just okay. Reruns. We haven't made it for a while, but I'm glad you've heard of it for your Sunday evening viewing. So yeah, I ended up doing that, and it was actually great fun to do. You know, it was two teams in a junkyard, and they had to build a machine out of junk, and they raced it against each other. And it had a bit of recycling in there, had a bit of engineering in there, a bit of science, but it was ultimately a game show. And I ended up making that over in the States for the Discovery Channel. It was called Junkyard Wars over there. Of course, they would call it something like that rather than Scrappy Challenge. And leading, you know, having a very nice lifestyle, living in the Hollywood Hills, getting paid quite a lot of money. But ultimately, I kind of felt it was quite a shallow existence, to be honest. And, you know, I don't know if you know LA at all, but it's quite a funny place to live. And I wanted to do something a bit more wholesome. I always wanted to make something with my hands that I could like hold in my hands. TV is very ethereal. You know, you work your ass off for 6 months to make this show, and then it kind of disappears and you have nothing really left but memories. But I wanted to make something a bit more physical that, you know, I could hold in my hands and be proud of making. And me and my missus, who's also out there, who I kind of got together with out there, we used to go down to the farmer's market in LA in Sunset and Vine, and we met all these amazing Californian olive oil producers from like who would come down from the Sonoma Valley and all those kind of places. They had these just delicious, green, fresh, fruity olive oils. And we got really into trying them and infusing them and, you know, making funny recipes with them. And we were like, well, you know, if we're kind of feeling funny about telly and this lifestyle, why don't we become olive oil farmers? And unfortunately, the idea kind of stuck. And we're both people who once we say something like that, we go through with it. So we researched, you know, as much as we could, and decided that we're going to move to Italy. We found an abandoned olive grove after looking for a couple of years. On the east coast of Italy in a region called La Marche, which a lovely, beautiful area of the country. They've been saying it's going to be the new Tuscany for about 20, 30 years. It's never going to be the new Tuscany, unfortunately, but it is beautiful, very rural. Yeah, so we moved there in, I think, about 2004 with our first child. Didn't speak much Italian, had no kind of background in agriculture, never started a business before. So it was a bit of a learning curve. And actually that's actually where I suppose the first idea or inspiration for Bread & Jam came from. So starting up a food business, did all my research. There's like no information on the internet about how to start up a food business. There's no manual. There was very little support. I couldn't find anyone to help. So we basically had to do it by, you know, trial and error, you know, working it all out ourselves, making lots of mistakes, screwing up on pricing, wasting money here, wasting money there, wasting time, packaging. So I always thought, well, why the hell isn't there like a bit more support for, like we're not the first people to have started a food business. So why isn't there more support for it? But we, you know, we're fairly smart people. We got great kind of research skills from TV. You know, that's one thing we did in TV. You would pick up a subject really quickly, work out how to research it, work out who the right people to speak to are. So we managed to sell our first harvest of olive oil to Selfridges. And we also really realized pretty soon that olive oil is a super hard business to make any money from. Like, you have one olive oil that costs a fiver and one olive oil that costs 25 quid. And, you know, what's the difference? What's extra virgin? What's first cold press? What all these terms? Like, people don't understand. And to educate the consumer was super difficult. So we were like, well, sod that. Let's come up with a different way of selling olive oil, which again goes back to our TV backgrounds about telling stories and creating a narrative. We came up with this idea where you could adopt an olive tree. And you got sent the harvest of oil from your tree. So, like, you could even come and visit your tree and give it a hug, and we'd show you around the olive grove. So we came up with this idea, built a website, and, you know, luckily it captured the vibe at the moment, with people going to start and go to farmers markets and wanting to know the provenance of their products, and again, storytelling. So that idea went very well, and we used all our kind of media contacts to kind of share the story, and people loved it. And it went all around the Hollywood circles. We have people like Barbara Streisand adopted an olive tree for Hillary Clinton and people like that. And it got loads of great press. And so I did that business for about 10 years, moved back to the UK, and then sold that business. And then that's kind of when the bread and jam story really starts. I remember the feeling of hopelessness at the beginning of my journey of building a food business. So I started a conference with another co-founder, Tara, called Bread and Jam. We basically, for 2 or 3 days, we got a load of food entrepreneurs in a room sharing information, sharing how they built their businesses, whether it's branding, whether it is finding a manufacturer, whether it's finding funding. And that's what Bread and Jam does now. It's a kind of annual conference with a few other events around it.
And I'm a little bit embarrassed because it came onto my radar during lockdown. I don't know whether you've actually discovered, because we've been, you know, more online and looking around. And I've never been to a physical event, but, you know, we've chatted before we've been recording, and I intend to kind of come this year because it sounds fantastic. But for somebody who's never been, what can they expect and what's going to happen this year?
Okay, so we've got our conference, our annual conference next month, the 20th and 21st of October. Again, for the second year running, we're doing it as a virtual event. So it's 2 days of talks, panels, and workshops. So we have talks from, like, you know, industry icons, the founders and CEOs of Innocent and Lucky Sane and Little Moons and Wicked Kitchen, kind of doing inspirational talks about their journey and their experiences and the learnings that they've had along the way. Actually, just to go back a step, in terms of the people who come, it's important to understand who they are. They're all food and drink entrepreneurs, from people who actually maybe even just have an idea that they want to, but they don't know how to do it. So they've got an idea for a food product or a subscription service or something like that, through to people who've been selling for several years. They're in the supermarkets, they're in the specialty retailers, they're in Ocado, and they want to scale their business. So it's kind of all SMEs, challenger brands who want to grow their businesses. So we have the inspirational keynotes, we have the panel rooms where it's panels of food entrepreneurs sharing their experiences of a particular topic. Maybe it's how to find a manufacturer. Maybe it's how to get your first retailer. Maybe it's how to, you know, do your branding properly. And then we have lots of workshops, on every topic you can imagine that you need to start or grow your food business. And another great aspect of it is one of the hardest things for food brands is accessing buyers. So we have this really great meet the buyer sessions. We have really good relationships with all the specialty retailers, all the bricks and mortar retailers, supermarket multiples rather, So we have buyers from Holland & Barrett, from Sainsbury's, from Ocado, from Asda, Whole Foods Market. They all come and they meet pre-selected producers. So it's a great opportunity.
Yeah, so from the sounds of things, it's pretty clear that the festival itself is a major support for founders within the category and within the industry, both food and drink. What would you say is the most important thing you want new founders to kind of take away from the festival when they come and when they attend?
I mean, obviously, I want them all to be inspired to see how other people have done it. But I also want, you know, every talk is full of lots of juicy information. I don't like kind of, we make sure the talks aren't like fluffy. They're very practical. They're very, you know, all these food entrepreneurs, they're spinning so many plates. You know, they're doing marketing, they're doing sales, they're doing branding, they're doing logistics. They all want a to-do list of how to kind of achieve these different challenges. So everything's quite practical. But I also want people to kind of understand that it's quite tough as well. I don't like people telling fluffy stories about, you know, all you need to do is work hard and be passionate and you'll succeed, because it's not like that. It's a lot more challenging than that. You really need to have all your ducks in a line. The chances of failure are pretty high. So I don't want people to come away with a kind of a false impression that it's easy, although that, you know, that's a hard thing for me to say.
I'm pleased you mentioned failure. It's something that we've touched on increasingly, because I think there's a couple of aspects I'd value your perspective on, because you deal with so many founders. First of all, is there your favorite failure story, which I assume is a kind of a phoenix-like one normally, isn't it? Or it could be one that is a complete disaster. But I think the other thing is, the second part of this question is, how would you advise founders, particularly when they've got a smaller team around them? So let's assume they've got a team and you can see that things are tough. Do you admit it to the team around you? Or because the kind of impression we get of founders is they're eternal optimists and everything is always amazing. So it's kind of favorite failure story. And how, as a founder, do you confront failure, particularly for those around you?
Good questions. I think in terms of the kind of failure piece first, I think that I don't have a particular story, but the way I see most businesses fail is actually, it's very simple. That they have a product that not enough people want. So you've got to really be hard on yourself at the beginning. You know, sure, you ask friends and family and your mum and your dad, you know, what they think of your product, but don't just rely on them. They're always going to tell you it's great and, you know, they'll buy it. But so many businesses are not going to find a big enough market to support them. And I think that even reframing this kind of whole idea of failure, I think it's often better to take a more scientific approach to starting a business. And it's not about whether your product fails or not. It's about kind of testing it. You're testing a hypothesis. Does this hypothesis work? If it doesn't, discover it quickly and pivot to a different product. And I just think that a lot of startups are too blinkered. They're too focused on, you know, their grandma's amazing marmalade recipe that the whole world is going to love. But you just got to be a bit more honest about it and a bit more scientific. And, you know, I actually learned the hard way through my first, this olive oil business. You know, I wasn't able to make the right judgment calls because it was so much part of my life. The business felt like it was, you know, part of my soul, part of my body. And the money in the bank account felt like it was my personal money. So ultimately, I kind of think, looking back on it, there are so many business decisions that I got wrong. And it took me... I was lucky enough to be able to sell that business, however. So it wasn't a failure, it was a success. But it took me that business and that process to learn to put a slight distance between me and the business. So I could really think scientifically and objectively, and not be too tied to a particular product or particular type of branding or particular name. About the second question about how, you know, you share the ups and downs. One of the most inspiring speakers that we had at Bread and Jam was a lady called Susie Walker. She had a brand called Primal Pantry, and you know, she had the whole room in tears, kind of telling her story of the highs and lows of it. And I think people do really appreciate honesty. You know, I think it's a personal choice ultimately what you share with your team or not. And you know, every team and every entrepreneur is different, I guess.
So Jason, how important is it to you and obviously the founders that you speak to and that you work with, to have a kind of this clear purpose for the brand from the offset?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly useful. I think brands with purpose and a mission are often more resilient, because you know, when things go really bad and you're faced with challenges, if you've got a purpose and a mission behind you, I think you're just going to persevere that much more. You know, you're going to be more resilient. But in terms of kind of branding and stuff, I think the whole branding journey for most brands is very is a kind of continual evolution. You don't necessarily have to have everything nailed at the beginning. It goes back to what I was saying about, you know, you got to think of it as a bit of a scientific test and learn journey. So, you know, what might be your purpose and mission at the beginning, you got to be open to that kind of evolving and changing it as you grow and build.
And I suppose that kind of comes into play when you're talking about communications and actual branding and logos, et cetera, like that, things like that as well. I suppose that also is one of those evolving processes.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, a lot of people, they start off, well, I would suggest that they start off once they have a product or a prototype to take it to a farmer's market, try it on a stall when they're opened up again. And you need a certain type of branding for that. You can get your mate or your brother or your sister or someone with a bit of talent to put something together. And then the next step is you want to take it to, you know, your local delicatessens, farm shops, to make sure that, you know, people will actually buy the product if you're not directly selling it to people. So again, you need to make sure your branding and your packaging design and your logo and your website is all kind of right for that. And then the next step would be to take it to some of the kind of bigger specialty retailers like Whole Foods Market and Planet Organic and Selfridges. Again, you know, you want to evolve to that. And then the next step is like Ocado, where it's much more mass market. It's fairly low volumes, but you're kind of getting national distribution. So there's often a bigger kind of rebranding at this stage. And then Ocado kind of leads you to the bigger bricks and mortar multiples. So yeah, it's absolutely a constant evolution. I've seen businesses do it many different ways. You know, one thing that we do at Bread and Jam, if we have a panel on how to do your branding, we'll have three people who've done it completely different ways and all succeeded. There's no one way to skin a cat. You can, if you have a clear idea, you can find a fantastic branding agency right from the beginning, before you've even launched, get them to do the whole kind of landscape, research, tone of voice, brand Bible, color palettes and everything. And that can work as well. But you know, no, it's a slightly bigger gamble. So the other way that I described before is maybe, again, it's a bit test and learn. You can do a bit more organically. You don't need a chunk of cash from the beginning.
This often comes up when a business is at that scale-up phase, when they're kind of questioning whether things are all right. I'd love to get your point of view on the founder and her or his behavior at the point of scale up, because I'll put this to you. The founder who was great at running a startup may not be great at scaling up, because it's quite a different experience, is it? What's your experience? What have you observed?
I agree with you entirely there that they, they might not be the best person to take it forward. And that is, you know, one of the biggest challenges that they face. Letting go is incredibly, incredibly difficult. I'm always a big fan, again, from my experiences of not doing it solo. I always recommend to people that finding a co-founder is key. Someone that, you know, you want to impress, someone that wants to impress you, someone you can bounce ideas off, and someone who has a kind of different skill set to you. So as often I've seen the more successful businesses, as they've grown, the two founders are kind of able to look after different parts of the business. But, you know, a classic one, Emma Heal, who's now running Lucky Saint. She's the CEO. The founder bought her in, and it has worked so well. But he was inspired to kind of find her, persuade her to get involved. She's kind of ex-Grays, ex-Innocent. But it's not something that many people manage to do well, I have to say.
I'm sure this is something you likely talk about at the Bread & Jam Festival that you have coming up next month. But what trends within the category are you most excited by? Are there any opportunities that you've seen that have started to open up in the last, you know, 12 to 18 months?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing, I mean, obviously, I can't not mention plant-based. You know, it's still absolutely rampant. There's still lots of opportunity there. Areas in there that I'm kind of interested in is I kind of think, you know, there's going to be a kind of what I'm calling a vegan 2.0. Basically, a lot of people have gone to this plant-based diet because of health. It's health, then sustainability, and then animal welfare, the kind of three drivers, but health has always been dominant. People think a vegan diet is more healthy. However, a lot of these products that are being released are super processed, filled with ingredients that you can't kind of, you know, you can't pronounce, methylcellulose and stuff like that. And I think that there's going to be an explosion of plant-based products that are really plant-based. They're like all natural. They're not kind of come from a wet moisture extrusion kind of machine. And so I think that's going to be something that we're going to see more and more. There's this new HFSS legislation coming through. I don't know if you know what that is. It's high fat, sugar and salt products that they're not going to be allowed to be sold like near the point of sale, near the cash tills. So all those all sugary sweet bars and stuff, they got to move, and they can't do like 2-for-1 offers on them. And there's lots of legislation coming in around them. So there's a huge opportunity for kind of healthy, indulgent snacking and treats. There's obviously like cold, flu and immunity products that are massive at the moment with the COVID and people being so much more in tune with their own personal health and gut health as well. Breakfast drinks and functional breakfast is something that I've seen quite a lot of. And I speak to a lot of product developers and they're working on lots of ideas around that topic. Eco-labeling is another kind of exciting thing that it's not really a product, but it's a exciting thing happening in food and drink. So, you know, it's like the carbon footprint, life cycle analysis of each product and what is the carbon cost of it. I'm always like super confused when I go into a supermarket and it's like, do I buy apples from South Africa or from North Africa or from England? And the English ones, they might have been refrigerated for several months in a you know, high energy sucking refrigerator, and it's all a bit overwhelming for the consumer. And there are several eco labels coming in, and hopefully one will dominate and it will become the industry standard, and people will become much more fluent in the whole kind of carbon cost of things.
Quite a lot there. Genuinely, I am excited about the manufactured meat. I've probably got the wrong word for it, but you know the one I mean, where they actually grow meat, because I have become increasingly concerned about animal welfare, but I am a bit of a protein junkie. And I know I can have, vegan protein, but there's nothing like a good chunk of chicken. So a nice lab-grown piece of chicken is going to be top of my list, so I can't wait to try it, unless you've tried it already, have you?
No, I haven't. I mean, I'm in a bit of a funny situation. I've been a vegetarian for over 40 years, and I think absolutely 100% behind the philosophy of lab-grown meat, but whether I could actually eat it, I'm not sure. So it's been commercially sold for the very first time in Singapore. There's a lot of legislative issues around, licensing issues around lab-grown meat, and Singapore was the first government to grant a license. So actually, you can, if you do want a chicken nugget, a lab-grown chicken nugget, head over to Singapore and try it. It's the same guys who invented Just Egg over in the States. And once they nail that, the market is absolutely huge. It's a game changer. It's really exciting.
I think it will explode. I wanted to go back to the founders themselves. And I'll be honest, Jason, a bit of a hobby horse of mine in general is how our world isn't as inclusive as it should be. And I observe, correct me if I'm wrong, that the founder community is a little bit sexist. I mean, I've heard horror stories about how women founders raise less money. Obviously, there are less of them out there as well. You know, the visibility of black founders is kind of zero. I mean, what can we do, and what can Bread and Jam do as well to try and make the founder community more welcoming and inclusive?
Yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely 100% in agreement. I'm one of the guys I work with. He's black guy, started a food business, but he said, you know, when he was growing up, the only, you know, role models he had were footballers and rappers. And so, like you, you know, I'm a white middle-aged man, and I think I have benefited immeasurably from, you know, this system, and therefore I'm, you know, part of the problem, and I feel it is my duty to, and I'm very happy to try and do something about that. And one of the things I can do is help give exposure to role models. There are some fantastic non-white kind of food founders out there. And I, you know, when I put together the program for each event, I'm very conscious of having a diverse kind of panel of speakers. Haven't always managed to, but I have to say, it's getting easier and easier. So we have a really good diversity of speakers, and I think that's one thing I can do. There's also some great people making a more concerted effort. There's a great food and drink incubator for black-owned businesses called Salt. It's spelled P Salt. We try and help them as much as we can. Actually, the one of the founders of that is also the MD of Innocent Drinks, and he's speaking at Bread and Jam.
So, talking of Bread and Jam, and kind of giving us a little bit of a preview of it, of the festival coming up in October, just throughout the podcast. But it'd be good to hear from you a little bit of a preview of where, as to what we can expect. So, what kind of things can people expect to hear about, or the kinds of people they're expecting to hear from?
Okay, I mean, so in general, what we try to do is answer all the questions you would have if you said, how do I start a food business, or how do I scale my food business? So we've only got 2 days to kind of provide that information, but I think we got most things kind of generally covered. So that's what you should expect, to learn lots about how to start or scale your business. And in terms of kind of some of the speakers, I mean, we've got a fantastic roster of speakers. We're lucky because, you know, I've been in the community a long time, able to kind of get really good people to come and share their experiences. And some of the highlights for me, we've got Derek Sarno, who has almost single-handedly driven the kind of plant-based movement in the UK. He's head of plant-based innovation at Tesco's. He's got an amazing brand called Wicked Kitchen. He's a very inspiring kind of vegan chef. So he's going to be speaking. We've got the guys from Little Moons. I don't know if you know much about Little Moons, but they're the Moochie Bulls have been an absolute phenomena on TikTok. They've got like 50 million views of 50 million uses of their hashtag. I think their sales in Tesco's rocketed by 700% when it kind of went viral on TikTok. So they're going to be talking about their experiences. Amazing brother and sister couple who build their own factory. They're going to be talking about how to nail it on TikTok. We've got Emma Heal, who I mentioned earlier from Emma Heal from Lucky Saint. She's got an amazing background at Innocent Drinks and then at Grays. Grays was originally all online, and then they had a retail proposition, and she built that from zero to 50 million turnover and then left to do Lucky Saint. Lucky Saint, a non-alc, non-alc beer, and they've really been driving the category. It's like a non-alc beer that is bloody delicious. So they have a great product. We obviously got lots of stuff on D2C. D2C is one area where food businesses have seen growth. You know, obviously food service kind of disappeared overnight. Retail has been more challenging, but D2C, it's a fantastic opportunity for food brands to sell direct to their consumers, to communicate directly, to market directly with the people who are buying their products. So we'll do lots of things around that, you know, from building websites to marketing to, you know, the back end logistics of D2C. And we've got some fantastic retailers coming along. The bigger supermarkets are super interested now in working with challenger brands. They're getting a lot of crap from the discounters. You know, if you want to buy a pack of Coca-Cola, you don't go to Sainsbury's, you go to Lidl. So Sainsbury's therefore have to have exciting new brands to kind of pull in the customers. Ocado want to do that. Morrison's want to do that. Asda want to do that. So we're hearing from quite a few retailers about, you know, how they're working with challenger brands.
So I've learned that you've had a great career in TV. You know, I you didn't mention you also worked at Unruly, so you understand all of that kind of world as well. And you know that our signature question is about TV, but it's in our world of advertising and marketing. So I am with bated breath await asking you, Jason, what is your all-time favourite TV ad? Why? And obviously describe it, because we're in audio.
For sure, yeah. I mean, it is a tough question. There are so many kind of iconic ads that I thought of way back in the day, from the Flake advert and things like that. But the one that kind of has stood out to me most recently is the Oatly advert with that killer tune about Wow No Cow. So it's the Oatly CEO, Tony Peterson, who's a fantastic character, sitting in an oat field with the old, I don't know, Casio keyboard, crappy old keyboard, playing a song, which is basically, he wrote, apparently, probably in less than 10 minutes, because it's pretty basic, but incredibly catchy. And he's kind of saying, wow, no cow, it's milk, but for humans, which has been a bit of a tagline for Oatly milk. So obviously, if you don't know, Oatly milk is a plant-based milk, and which has become a huge category in the UK in just a matter of few years. So it's like a very super simple advert, really kind of bold, nonconformist. And why I like it was the kind of also the story of it. It was shown in the advert break of the last American Super Bowl, which I'm thinking, I mean, I don't know much about it, but it's got to be some of the most expensive ad space in the whole planet. And it's this weird Scandinavian guy singing a song in a field, and I'm sure it didn't look like any of the other slick, you know, high value adverts that were either side of it.
Well, no cow. No, 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 wow, wow, no cow, no, no, no.
Harry and I were chatting about it offline, and there's so many stories around this ad. Harry, you said that Tony Peterson didn't know he was being filmed. I mean, yeah. You know, who stands in a field with a Casio keyboard not realizing they're being filmed?
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange story behind it. So originally it was actually recorded in 2017. So obviously something that they've had in the locker for a while, and decided to use for the 2021 Super Bowl TV spot. But yeah, apparently it's recorded in and around these organic oat fields of southern Sweden, where the kind of head office of Oatly actually is. And in order to kind of make sure that people who watched it got a real viewpoint of Tony and the kind of person he is, much of the footage was actually filmed without him knowing. So I'm sure he was aware that he was filming something, but they were kind of filming it as he was just playing around and having fun to try and show this kind of very real idea of who he was. And even they didn't show him any of it either until they were kind of about to broadcast it as well, all the way back in 17 or before they released it, because they thought it would be important to people to see this kind of honest view of who Tony is and how he's trying to take Oatly from being this kind of plant-based milk variant to this kind of more offbeat, dynamic lifestyle brand. And I think if you're thinking all the way back to 2017, when they were first kind of starting out as this massive challenger, and you look at them now in 2021 as the kind of pinnacle of what people see as the plant-based milk category, it seems to have worked, at least, which is good.
A super, super interesting kind of branding story behind that. I think even Tony said it himself, it's like a 30-year overnight success, that business. You know, it's a super, super old business. Tony was bought in the around the time that, you know, we're talking about, and totally changed it from a kind of fuddy-duddy branding to something very challenging, very vocal, very different, a tone of voice. It's you know, Innocent created this kind of idea of tone of voice, and every food brand has been trying to copy that for ages. But then Oatly kind of came along with another very original way of speaking to people. And it just shows, you know, the power of that in terms of suddenly escalating its success.
Yeah, it's definitely a brand that has had a big impact, such a big impact, in fact, that it's the ad itself has been banned in Sweden due to the Swedish dairy industry lobbying against it. So, yeah, a very, very powerful kind of impact that that Tony's had on that company, for sure.
A very punk-like mark of success, getting banned. Yeah, it takes me back to my 1970s. Jason, thank you. Thank you for giving us a lot to talk about with that Oatly ad. And I think, it's brought to light lots of things in my mind, which is, you know, for a scale-up brand to do, I mean, it wasn't really a scale-up brand, as you said, it's like the 30-year overnight success, but to go from what we thought of it as this kind of small, organic, see it in Whole Foods markets, to being, you know, in the pride of place in the Super Bowl ads, that's quite an impressive story. And, you know, we were chatting off line, lots of people in the industry are beginning to think that Oatly is sold out. Whether it has or not, it is incredibly successful. They're making an awful lot of money, so they've got something right. So I think we can learn something from them. I think we'd love to come and join you at Bread and Jam this year and hear all of the people that you've talked about. People who are listening, how can they get involved?
Oh, well, absolutely. So I'd love lots of people to come along. It's 21st of October. You can buy tickets now from www.breadandjamfest.com. And for people who kind of want to meet retailers, you have to apply to pitch through our website. At the very least, join our mailing list. We'll tell you all about it. We also have a Facebook group called the Food Hub Forum, which has got 11,500 food and drink entrepreneurs on there, sharing advice and support, so people can get involved with that too.
Looking forward to seeing you again on screen in October. Jason, it's been fascinating. Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Wax Lyrical, the scale up and change up marketing podcast from Wax On. Wax On are advertising and branding experts for scale-up businesses, helping you grow famously. Find out more at wearewaxon.com.